This is a WGNS Action Line. Action Line. Talking with Rutherford County newsmakers for 78 years.
Since 1947.
It's how my day begins.
It's how his day begins.
This is a WGNS Action Line. Now, your host, Scott Walker.
Leaving a controlling and abusive marriage is one of the hardest, most terrifying steps that a survivor can take. And today on the show, we have a guest, Michelle, who did just that. But there's a lot to her story. Emotional and psychological abuse often begin quietly, isolating the victim, eroding self-worth, and creating a constant sense of fear. And over time, the control becomes all-encompassing, making escape feel not just difficult, but dangerous, and making it feel impossible. Now we're going to be talking with Michelle. We'll hear about her story. And Michelle, how are you this morning?
I'm good, Scott. Thank you.
You got married thinking everything's going to be great, but things didn't quite turn out that way, which is true for a lot of people in a lot of marriages these days. Talk to us about that and how it started.
To make a quick disclaimer, I'm not a public speaker, and I do have the thick accent, but when I had the opportunity to see your publication from where my husband, now ex-husband, Rex Martin, lost his appeal from where the charges were brought forth due to the incident that occurred in our lives on May 17th of 2021. It just really brought forth a lot of emotions to me when I read your story and the information that I had tried so hard to swallow was just kind of out there for the general public to see. That's when I visited the thought of, well, you know, this information is out here and I need to stop being ashamed of it, stop being afraid of what people will think. But my childhood had been basically an episode, reoccurring episode of Law and Order, and it was less than nurturing. I was the stepdaughter of a 30-year Marine Corps veteran. Master Gunnery Sergeant was his retiring title, and that is when I realized what hell was as a child. My childhood was something that I never dreamed that would happen, because up to my mother marrying this man, I had been pretty much a spoiled brat. But when you enter a household of a United States Marine Corps veteran, that's no longer so. There's no room for any spoiled children, especially stepchildren. And that's when I first learned to overcome and swallow my emotions and basically just suck it up and go on with your life. By being reared in that type of environment, when I married Rex, we did have a storybook courtship. We had a magical wedding. The wedding took place at Post Ranch Inn in Big Sur, California. We had a harp player. We were gifted a bottle of champagne from Daniel Craig during the reception. I just thought that all of my troubles would be over, because with Rex, I had learned to forget about basically my childhood and my untrusting tendencies, because I felt like that he was going to make everything fantasy for us in our marriage. And we had a good life. I thought that we did. I did not realize he was so unhappy in the marriage. We'd had a lot of common interest. We enjoyed a lot of the same activities. We had a lot of the same vocabulary, the same sense of humor. And due to my childhood, I never realized that my life with Rex was being abusive or was being anything other than fantasy, because where I had been reared and what I had experienced as a child, anything was better. with Rex being the jealous type, I mistakenly took his actions as flattery. Like so many women do, I thought that his behaviors of monitoring my phone and placing a tracking device on my car, I just thought those were showing acts of love and acts of caring, because he was so concerned that something was going to happen to me, and he wanted to be aware of my presence at all times. I just thought, oh, he loves me so much. He cares so much about me and doesn't want anything to happen. Whereas now I realize that was part of his problem, part of his jealousy, and it turned out it wasn't flattery at all. It was controlling behavior. And there were so many signs and red flags that I just did not notice during our relationship of his controlling behavior, because, again, I was flattered. Just couldn't believe that he was paying me this much attention and went to such efforts to maintain my security and my well-being. But we were married in 2010, and in May would have been an anniversary month for us, because we married in May 29, and we'd never had any physical altercations. We argued a lot. I kind of thought as the arguments is our love language, because we would both flare, have arguments, and then kiss and make up and go on about our business. I just, again, was blindsided that really wasn't the optimal way to live in a relationship. At the time of the incident, I was working, and he had been working a lot of overtime, and I was working overtime. He came home from work early. I was not expecting him to come home, but he came home early, approached my desk where I was working, walked in, and he sat calmly on the edge of my desk, and he told me that he was going to kill me.
We start our lives, we have all these dreams, hopes, and goals, and a picture in our head sometimes as to what we think life should look like. We go on to get married to our spouse, and again, we have this picture in our head as to what we think how great life is going to look from here on out. And as life continues, it sounds like things slowly start to unravel. Realizing I thought it was one thing, but no, it's not. It's control. And lead up to this point in your life and his life where he calmly says, I'm going to kill you. I can't imagine your feelings at that point.
Just to retrace a little bit, Scott, I was not a young bride. He was not a young groom. We had both been married previously, and by being older, you think you have everything figured out. You know, you've already made your mistakes with the first or second or third or whatever, and this is going to be it, because I was 36 when we married, and there was just not going to be any mistakes in this marriage. Everything's going to be, you know, peaches and cream. And when he walked in and sat on my desk and calmly said that he was going to kill me, I thought he was joking.
That would be the furthest thing from your mind.
It was really an aggravation to me, because the time, it was approximately 10:20 at night, and my cutoff to turn in my overtime work is 11 p.m. By him coming in and interrupting my workspace at 10:20, when I had so many things that I needed to finish up and close out for my shift, I just thought, what is he carrying on? Why is he choosing now to aggravate me like this?
At that point, you guys had been married for how many years? 11 years?
Yes. Uh-huh.
So you are at your 11th year, and then he says he's going to kill you, and then what happened after that? You went through hell. And how much did you go through?
I believe that was And the way that I keep time, and I have testified this as well, and it's on record within Rutherford County court system, that I kept time by Mike and Molly was on. I was watching reruns or listening to TV while I was doing my work. And I remember Mike and Molly had gone off, and Two Broke Girls had come on. Well, that was at 11 when that show came on. So there was the talking of I'm going to kill you, and that went on probably 15 minutes because, as I said, I was very aggravated that he was disturbing me because my overtime work was so monitored that every I has to be dotted, every T has to be crossed, or I would lose that privilege of getting to work overtime. I just couldn't believe how he was coming in and interrupting. So when he said that I'm going to kill you, I just thought he was joking. And he sat on the edge of my desk and he took off my eyeglasses. I thought, well, he really is joking. He's going to kiss me, because when we kiss, either a quick or a longer kiss, you know, he took off my glasses. And I thought, well, why is he bugging me? He knows I have to have my glasses. So I reached and I grabbed my glasses and I put them on. He said again, I'm going to kill you. I just thought, okay, well, all right. And we had talked about things in the past, me being a nurse, how shooting or an explosion or something that comes out of the blue would be a welcome death versus being sick with cancer or being a long, drawn-out illness before you die. And I thought, well, okay, if this is what it is, you know, still thinking it was a joke, but in case that it's not, let's just get it over with. So I told him, I said, well, okay, I'm ready. And by me saying that, it really set him off, because I don't know if he expected me to beg and plead, just go ahead and kill me, was my thoughts. Just get it over with. I fully expected him to pull a weapon from his rear waistband and just shoot me if he was that adamant.
And at this point in y'all's lives, 11 years, you have not had any physical altercations or fights or anything along those lines, or had you?
We had had an incident, which is really more than an incident, when we lived in California. We had a home in San Jose, California. We had lived there for 8 years, and there was an incident where he had been drinking, I guess with the alcohol and your thought process, the way his apparently was. The more you drink and the more you plot, he was determined that I was cheating on him. You know, that was the farthest thing from my mind. It always has been. Even now, I feel like I'm still married to him. He was convinced that I was cheating, and we had an argument at our home in California. He told me that he would be better off just going to a location in San Jose and getting him a prostitute.
For those who are listening, the story of what happened to you, these are things that nobody out there listening ever thinks is going to ever happen to me. You know, that's the furthest thing from our mind when we get married. We don't believe our loved one is going to do something to physically harm us. And when a traumatic event occurs to us, when we go through something tragic or traumatic, it seems like these types of events almost happen in slow motion. And for you, you were saying it lasted, I think, you around 15 minutes even. But the things that occurred, you thought you were going to die. He even bound you to a chair and left you in a room. The things that happened are just crazy.
Going back to an incident in California, we had this argument and he shoved me. He did not hit me or anything. He shoved me, and with his fingernail, it had left a long gash on my legs, because he was going to really show me at that time what he was going to do to the prostitute. on Story Road is what he said. And he was ripping off my clothes, and I guess he caught himself. And I thought, oh, I cannot let this go on. And like so many women, I pressed charges. And long story short, Rex did go to jail. He spent 6 months, but we had contact while he was in jail through letters, and he made me believe that I pushed him to the edge and that it was my fault that he exploded like that. And sure enough, I did not stick with the charges. I did not testify during his hearings in California because it was my fault. I did press him. I should have known better. You know, I shouldn't have done that. He's right. So that was the mindset that I had, was it was all my fault. I shouldn't have done that. So fast forward, and the DA in California actually told me, this is not the end of it, Miss Martin. He's going to do this again, and next time you won't be so lucky. And I actually told her, no, ADA, I pressed him to this. It wasn't his fault. It's mine. I shouldn't have done it. And I was told over and over, no, it was not your fault. But I just refused to listen because the blame was on me. It was my fault. Fast forward these years later, here we are again. And this time, it didn't occur to me that it was really real, that it was happening, until when I told him that I was ready. As I spoke, that did send him off, you know, in an explosion. And he had a few choice words, which I did testify in court, that I was going to feel it. I was basically not going to get the easy way out by a gunshot. Before I knew, I was down in front of my desk. He was straddled me with his knees on my arms. My arms were up over my head, and his knees were on my arms. And I just kept thinking, what is going on? Stop. That hurts. And that is when I realized this is my husband. He is beating me across the head. I had a flashback of Rocky in the gym from the movie Rocky, where he's hitting the punching ball. And that's how hard and fast that the blows were coming, because Rex grew up in an era where you fist fought. You know, you took care of all of your problems physically out in the street or out on the playground. And he was really a fighter, a street fighter. And this was my head. And I kept thinking, stop that. What is that? So I don't know if he got tired of the punches, but then he started choking me. And as I was laying there being choked, I kept thinking, well, when am I going to pass out? Because you see on TV, that's the closest I've been to these kind of incidents is on TV.
I don't mean to interrupt, but for those listening, when you're in a domestic violence type relationship, the manipulator, the person who does the abuse, the person who does track your every move and questions you everywhere you go, they're so good at manipulating that they can convince their spouse, their girlfriend, whoever it may be, that it's their fault. It, just like what he was saying to you. And that all came up again this time around in this most recent event that sent him to prison. But it came up again where he blamed you unleashing this side of him. And of course, now looking back in reality, the reality of it is, you know, you don't have the power to control somebody to that extent to make them do something like that to you. And I think that's one of those things that it's really hard for somebody who's in the middle of all of that chaos to come to that realization that I didn't make him do this. He's a grown man. He's able to make his own decisions. I didn't cause this. But that's a hard place to be. So going back to where you were in this situation just a few years back, he's hitting you, physically beating you. What happened next?
During the choking episode, like I said, I just kept waiting to pass out. because that's what I thought would happen. I would be choked and I was going to be unconscious. And I was praying to be unconscious because it was such misery. The beating, the blows to the head, yeah, that hurt. But the choking was just something I cannot describe because it didn't happen quickly. I don't know if he would ease up and let me have some air, because when I looked at his eyes, again, as I had described in court, his eyes were gleaming. They were sparkling while I looked at his eyes and I was choking.
Like this rage and had come over him.
It was rage, but it seemed like the closest thing to ecstasy that I could imagine, because they were so sparkly. Just pure joy was in his eyes that I could not imagine. Even TV cannot reflect what I saw in his eyes. And clearly, by me being choked for so long, it was pleasure to him, is what I interpret. Because he was in the military. He knows how to cut off the carotid artery. He could have caused the unconsciousness, but to me, he purely enjoyed seeing me like that.
It was like an animal playing with their food before they kill it. What you're talking about, it had to have been, of course, surreal, as you described it. But the fear inside of all that is just crazy. And I know we don't have a whole lot of time left, but as you fast forward, all of these things that occurred, as the beating, if you would, continued, at one point, he left the house. This is a God thing, but Murfreesboro police, you were able to find an old cell phone and called 911. And police, from what I understand, showed up at the house when he decided to come back to the house.
Yes, at the time, there was a lot more that occurred, but like you said, we are on a time constraint. But he took me and he bound me in our bedroom, and he had duct taped me. Basically, I had little dinosaur arms sticking out by the way that he had duct taped me like a mummy. My mouth was not duct taped, but my body was wrapped. But I could still move some fingers, and I could hear him back and forth in the house. And I could hear his cowboy boots on the floor, and he was pacing and pacing and pacing. And then I heard the truck start. I thought, well, you know, he's gone. And why he come back, I can only imagine he came back to finish the job.
For folks to understand, he locked you into a bedroom. The way he did that, I guess he took the knobs or something off the door so you couldn't get out, but you were able to, thankfully, and you eventually found an old cell phone in the house because he took your phone, and you were able to call 911. Now, going back to where he, I guess, decided to come back and finish you off, that, I mean, that's scary in itself, of course. Walk us through what happened towards the end of that.
This is the part that is most amazing to me, Scott, because I never knew that I had a will to live. I would imagine my previous self is just laying down and taking it. And from God Almighty, it had to have come from His strength, because I was able to wiggle and worm and throw myself off the bed and use my little dinosaur arms to open an Ardmore. And I was going to just fall backwards out of the window and try to scoot over to my neighbors. But I couldn't really force enough to break the window for me to fall out. And when I was looking through the Ardmore, which I opened with my mouth and my tongue, there were bunches of hunting knives. And I was able to take my hands and basically inchworm, because I was taped, and use the knife to pry open the door. I stuck it in between the cracks and prized it, and the door pried right open because it's cheap material. And then I crawled on my stomach like an inchworm all the way up the 17 stairs to the bonus room, because that's where I had left my phone. And I knew that I had to call somebody because I was afraid that I was going to be blind from the beating because I could not see. And it just kept going through my mind that I've got to get to the ER. I've got to get to the ER because I have got to see. I've got to see and able to do my job because I just cannot live on SSDI that I would get from disability. I can't pay my bills on that. I've got to get my eyes taken care of. And that was just all going through my mind is I have to work. I have to work.
You survived all of this, and it took over 18 months for you to recover from some of the injuries. Now, as far as the eye injuries go, are you still recovering from those today?
My vision is not what it was, but with my glasses, I can see. I have nothing that prohibits me from doing basically anything I want, but just yesterday, I had to go for a CT scan because out of the blue, my left arm and wrist and hand has been swollen for 2 weeks to the point where I can't close my hand. And the beating and the assault is like the gift that keeps on giving. You think it's done, but here it comes again. So this edema has to be related to my assault and breakage of my left arm because I've not heard it. So it just keeps on going.
And police get there and they intervened. They got there just in time and they were able to place him in handcuffs. And what followed, of course, the case went through the judicial system and he was sentenced to prison. And I believe that prison sentence ends around 2036 or somewhere along those lines, and he'll be like 75 or maybe a little bit older at that point. But he filed an appeal thinking, I guess, in some way that he could have this case to where his sentence was reduced, and that did not happen. The appeals court said no to that. For anybody out there listening, what's the one thing that's more important than ever that you would say to them if they are in a relationship where their spouse, their husband, their boyfriend, girlfriend is tracking their every move, is questioning everything they do. And then when they get mad at them, they blame it on them and say, "You're the one that unleashed this in me." What would you say to that person?
I would like that person to learn from my mistake that, no, this is not flattery. This is not love. This is not attention. This is stalking criminal behavior, and start putting your money aside. Start thinking for you. Start planning a way out before something happens like it did with me. I had no clue that I was going to be in this position. I had nothing prepared. Just pay attention to the signs that something is not right, and pay attention to what people tell you and point out to you that this is not love, this is not flattery. Prepare to depend on yourself, because in healthcare and myself as well, the public's outpouring and your friends and your family and whatnot, they want to see the gore, they want to hear the story, but you've got 2 weeks, basically. You're either going to get better or die, because that's what you're given in the public's mindset. And that's how long your pity or support is basically going to last, because something else happens. People move on and, you know, you're forgotten. You need to be able to support yourself, be your own cheerleader, love yourself, and protect yourself like you would a newborn baby. Because when it boils down to it, you are all you have.
Even after the abuser is behind bars, that trauma lingers and the victims are left to piece together shattered confidence, rebuild their lives, and somehow learn to feel safe again.
If he didn't kill me quickly by gunshot in the beginning, when he came back, I was really going to be tortured.
Michelle, hold on just for a second, because we do have a whole lot more to come. We'll be right back.
Bigger isn't always better. When it comes to your financial institution, don't send your money to some far-off bank in another state. At Heritage South Community Credit Union, We help when others won't. We've been serving our community since 1957 and are still locally owned and operated in Middle Tennessee. If you're tired of talking to artificial intelligence and computer screens and branches, give Heritage South a try. Learn more at heritagesouth.org. Insured by NCUA.
FM 1019, FM 100.5, WGNSradio.com. The Good Neighbor Network.
I'm a single mom, and as you can imagine, it's a fight sometimes just to get out the door. But when I need new tires or something's wrong with my car, I need the head of someone I can trust. I go to Tire World.
Tire World, we keep your family rolling.
Tire World, locally owned and operated.
WGNS Action Line.
Now your host,
Scott Walker.
The morning sun so bright, warms my heart just right. On my tip, on my tip.
We are talking to Michelle and her life, what she went through, what she survived. Well, there's a lot of other lives out there, I'm sure, who their life, their marriage, their relationship with their boyfriend, girlfriend, whatever the case is, it started out in a lot of the same ways that your life, Michelle, your life started out as. And I know in the very beginning, you were talking about how in childhood, you grew up in this home where there were things that happened that kind of led you to believe, and I guess it almost made it feel like these things are normal and they do happen. And that may have been domestic violence of some sort. But as we go forward to what occurred in your marriage after 11 years, your husband attacked you and told you he's going to kill you, and you survived it. Bring us back up to the point of where you're tied up, you're bound, and he left. Your husband left the house for just a little while. And again, you said that what was going through your mind was that you were afraid he was going to come back and kill you. So what happened after you freed yourself enough to get out of that room that he locked you in?
Once I was able to pry open the door and I made the, for lack of a better term, inchworm attempt and climbed the stairs on my stomach and my elbows, and I had an old cell phone that I used to play music, and I remembered that you could dial 911 on a non-serviceable phone. So I took this phone and didn't really have the dexterity to use my fingers to try to swipe up and get the phone on and get to the keyboard. So I was using my tongue. I was using my nose. I was using anything I could just to try to get that phone open and get a connection to 911. And I made the connection, and that's another thing. I got so aggravated while I was on the phone with 911 because with my teeth loose and my mouth bloody and the vomit and everything, they couldn't understand me. And I just felt like that I was yelling and yelling from the trauma to my throat. I don't guess much was coming out for them to hear. And I just thought, well, you know, he's going to be here. He's going to come back. He's going to catch me. Why don't they understand? Later on, I realized that maybe they could have heard, but the intent was to keep me on the phone because if I was on the phone and they could hear, they would know that I was alive and they could hear what was going on in the background. Once I got them, I had my little senior Yorkie. And she was following me, and I was thinking, oh, they're going to come in. The police are going to come in through the front door. It has a glass front. Josie is going to cut her feet on that glass. I've got to do something. So I inchwormed basically head first down the stairs and tried to get over to the front door and try to get that open again, putting the knob under my arm. I really don't know how I opened it because it's really hard to turn anyway, but I believe I got it open.
When you called the police, you knew in your mind, you knew he was coming back for you, and you were right.
I felt like he would come back And when he caught me out of my tied up place, that I was really going to be in trouble. And I was feared because he had a moment's time to plot. And if he didn't kill me quickly by gunshot in the beginning, when he came back, I was really going to be tortured. And that was my fear of how I had to hurry to get them there, because I didn't want him to come back and do torture. Because you hear, I had it easy compared to so many other victims. You know, there's so many things he could have done. He could have poured gas and set me on fire, could have poured acid. With him having that amount of time to plan and plot, that's what made it really emergent that I wanted to get the police there to take me to the ER, because, you know, I'm worried that I can't see and I have to work. That was going through my mind. I have to work and I don't want my dog to cut her feet on this glass. So I heard the truck coming back, and that's when I ran into a real panic, because I was holding that Bluetooth speaker and talking to the EMS with that speaker, and I knew that I couldn't turn it off, and that if he heard that, you know, that was really going to cause some trouble. So I just told him that he's here, and I just pitched that speaker and hoped that he wouldn't be able to hear the operator on the other end. I inched and inched back in the bedroom and tried to get back up on the bed, which I did make it. I did make it back up on the bed, and I was trying to lay down when the police came in. And that's when they said, "We've got him. We've got him. You're safe."
When you heard those words, what went through your mind when you heard police say, "We got him"?
I'm thinking, dead or alive? And I actually asked them, "Is he dead or is he alive?" "Oh, well, he's alive. He's alive." And I'm like, "Oh, you know, because as long as he's alive, there's still chance that he's going to come back and he's going to finish."
And it was definitely a blessing that Murfreesboro police arrived at her home just as that abuser, who was possibly coming back to do more harm, arrived at the home too.
Clearly, he had other things in mind that he was going to do. In court, he testified that he was at the gas station because he needed gas. So I don't know if he wanted to fill up cans. I don't know, you know, what he was doing, but I do feel like that he was coming back to do something more severe than what he had already done.
When I said earlier, whenever somebody goes through a real traumatic event, it's like everything is in slow motion. And that's kind of what we're hearing from you. You know, as you were going through all of this, one of the thoughts you kept thinking of, "I've got to be able to go back to work. I have to be able to go see patients. I have to be able to do these things. I have to have my vision." But these are things that are going through your mind. And I'm sure it felt like an eternity of time was going by, because if it happened in a 15 to 20 minute window, but yet you had time to think about all these other things. But it is wild to hear how time almost stood still for a little while there for you, and you were thinking of all these things. But again, the end result, police got him. He went to jail, I guess, that evening. Did he bond out within a day or two after this happened?
He was granted bond. He did go to a hearing, and it was set at $60,000, and no one would sign his bond or go for his bond for that amount of money. So he stayed from May until September. And in September, he asked for another bond hearing. Somewhere in between that time, he had come up with the money, and he bonded out in September, like September, the 20th week of September is when he bonded out. And that's when the fear really began.
2021, I guess, right?
Yes.
He's out of jail, awaiting court. You're left to wonder, is he going to try to find me again? Is he going to hurt me again? Is he going to try to kill me?
Yes, I have to say that was the most panicked portion, because He's been told that he's going to go to prison, and who wants to go to prison for a job that they didn't complete? Who wants to go to prison for nothing? And that is what I dealt with day in and day out, my fear of him coming back to finish the job. And by him being an outdoors type, a survivalist, for him having his military training, there's so many ways that he could have ended my life. But more so than ending is the torture. That was all I could think was the torture, because the choking was unreal, what misery that was. He didn't go back to court until May, so I had all the months from September until May to worry and wonder and wait to see what he was going to do.
So after the court case, he was convicted of, you know, everything from kidnapping to aggravated assault. I forgot what all the charges were that he was convicted of, but he got sentenced to where his release is not until 2036. But he filed an appeal with the courts. Did you know that he even filed an appeal?
I knew that he filed an appeal because of my self-research. I would love to say that I was kept abreast and the domestic violence was there for me. All the people that deal with these kind of things, I would love to say that they went overboard in keeping me informed, but that was not the case, Scott. Everything that I knew or know came from self-research. And it's not that I was obsessed with knowing what was going on with him. I was obsessed with keeping myself and my pets safe.
You were still in that fight or flight mode, and I don't know how you would have gotten out of that mode. I mean, that's a tough place to be, because you're always wondering, am I safe today? What's going to happen tomorrow?
I'm still in that mode, Scott, because I am notified by the victim service fine link, any transfers that he makes, and he made so many suicide threats or what have you while he was in regular jail that he was being transported back and forth so many times to mental health facility in Nashville. Well, by the time I would get these alerts, he was already, you know, the trip had been made. He would be admitted and sometimes on his way back to the correctional facility before I ever got the alert. And, you know, it's like, has nobody watched The Fugitive? Do you not know how easy it is to perform these escapes? And I'm just out here, you know, by myself, thinking everything's fine, that he's locked up, because the alert system fails. When you're in his type of position, knowing that you're going to be incarcerated for a job not finished, who knows what's going through his mind? Who knows what he's plotting?
Is there life after all of this? I mean, for somebody who is thinking about trying to get out of an abusive relationship before it escalates to this point, once they're out, is there life after it? Because I know you said you're still in that fight or flight mode, but is there a light at the end of the tunnel? Are there good days?
I don't know the correct answer. I have just busied myself with so many other activities. My job has been less than supportive during this ordeal, and it kind of seems like society, they're watching, and you don't know the right thing to do. Are you supposed to be tough? Are you supposed to be strong? Because if you are, then you're fine. And if you act like you're fine, then nobody's going to help you because you're fine. If you act like you need help, well, you just need to get over it. You need to go on. It's been 4 years. You need to do something. I don't know what the answer is, how you're supposed to behave and what you're supposed to portray, but it happened last night, as far as I'm concerned. I'm still living in last night, and that is my problem. That's something that I have to work through, and how I have chosen to do that is to stay busy so that I don't have to think about it. In my case, there's so many obstacles that I have to overcome that keeps weighing me down. Like, we were a two-income family, and we were two high-paid income families. And we really never deprived ourselves of anything. But then when I come back and I go looking through our finances, because, you know, he's the one that handled all the finances because I didn't know what I was doing, you know, quote unquote. And the manipulation of what he did and what I allowed to be done, like cashing in my 401k. I've always had a good job as a nurse. I have tried to save for the future, but he had other plans. He could take this and he could take that and he could get a better return on the money. Well, here I am. I'm 52 years old. I'm not prepared for the future. He had not been paying our bills at the incident. Our house payment was in arrears for 2 months. The car payments hadn't been made. And so here's all this debt that I have incurred. There's nothing that I can really do because I did get divorced, but something is happening within my mortgage company that I'm paying for this house that I can't get transferred over to my name. It just goes on and on and on, the trouble that this has caused. And by me being unprepared, I'm mad at myself for not seeing the flags. I'm mad at myself for not keeping an eye on the money. I'm mad at myself for being this old and not set up for the future because I did entrust him to do better and make more money and compounded interest on our savings, which God only knows what he done with it. It basically boils down to how bad do you want to survive? When I've tried to talk to people, there's so many people that have had it worse than me. So I feel guilt that I can see, I can walk, I can use my arms. I don't have any disfigurements. But if I had disfigurements, people would shun me for sure because people do not want to come and look at the aftermath. You know, the initial blood and gore, that's interesting. But afterwards, the thoughts and prayers, they quit coming because it's old news. And, you know, people have better things to do. But I'm still stuck here in 2021 struggling. Just been a hard process, but I am alive. I am breathing. I have food, clothing, and shelter. But the mindset is something that I guess I've chosen not to address because I don't think that I could move forward if I just really sat down and thought about everything that had happened.
It's kind of like a waterfall of negativity that occurs. I mean, it's just a waterfall effect of the aftermath, everything that happens after you survive. I mean, those on the outside looking in, they really have no clue how to even look at it or understand it because they've never been through this. And I guess that would be the other really hard part about surviving domestic violence, about surviving a near-death experience. As we close this morning, you set up, was it a GoFundMe page?
I set up a campaign in order to... I'm trying to go to school, Scott. I'm trying to go to the mental health nurse practitioner program because I have a lot of insight on mental health things and incidences thanks to my own experiences. And even with that, the doors are closed. This program does not offer any student loan because the program is so short. There's no student loan available. My work does have scholarship, but they're not offering scholarship for this type program right now. The school does have a payment plan, but the payment options are so short and confined that it's a big lump of money in over a short period just to do this payment plan. And I'm at a point where there's only so many hours in the day that you can work. You can work multiple jobs, but here's the taxes. Well, we do have this tax break, but it only goes to a certain limit. And yes, it's a big limit, but I have big bills. I've got this house that I pay mortgage on, but I can't borrow against it because it's not in my name, even though I pay. I've paid an attorney, I've gone to court, but the mortgage company is not allowing me to assume this loan without Rex's signature. How am I supposed to go to the prison and ask him for a signature? And is he really going to give me a signature? He fought the divorce tooth and nail. I would have thought that he would have tried to have made amends by being easy in the divorce, but no, he fought it. And it ran up a lot of bills just to fight him back in the divorce because as bad as what the incident was, in the court's eyes, he was punished for his crimes. And divorce is equitable division of property. Everything he did had no bearing during divorce. And it's just been one door closing after another. This thing with the campaign that I've started, the giving campaign, and that's just for my school because I need to get in a higher income bracket in order to qualify to take over this house and to fight to get the documents ready. The school has to be paid. There's no place for federal funding with me because I don't have children. I am older. And by you putting the information out there on the news break, that was my indication that, hey, this is a platform that maybe I can use that is verifiable, that it's just not me trying to scam people. It is verifiable that these things did happen. And if there's people that are willing to give a little to help me give back to the community, because by going to school and by going into the mental health field, my whole ordeal has been affected by mental health. My childhood, that's mental health. The perpetrators, they were suffering from mental health illnesses. So I feel like this is an opportunity to give back to the community by giving an empathetic ear and trying to work through in order to prevent other people, whether it be victims or whether it be perpetrators. Let's get on the correct mindset. Let's try to help each other. But I have to have this licensure in order to do that. In order to get the licensure, you have to go through the program. And also, while you're in the program, the bills don't stop. Electric, water, mortgage. It's like, oh, well, you've got this house. You can sell it. You can borrow money against it. No, I can't because it's hung up in a mortgage entitlement situation. And, well, you could get a roommate. Well, the man that I loved and cherished for 11 years tried to kill me. I can't really just open up and rent out a room. I could go on and on, Scott.
The program that you're wanting to get into, about how expensive is that per semester?
It is about $3,500. It is local. It's MTSU. It is a certificate program. And from what I can calculate, the total cost is about $15,000. Which, you know, had I had this 401k that I didn't turn over to Rex, I could just borrow it against that. But guess what? That money is gone. My safety net is gone. It really seems like a minute amount, but by going to school, that will prohibit my ability to work other jobs and bring in more money.
Are you a nurse already?
Yes, I am a nurse already. I'm going past 30 years as being a licensed nurse.
The goal is to get into this program, and then after you graduate from it, after you get the certificate, then you're able to go back and help people who have been through some of the things that you went through and help them mentally at a level that probably only somebody who's gone through things like that could truly help somebody at least it seems that way in a lot of cases.
Well, that is my hope and that is my thought process. Now, whether or not my subconscious is using this as a way to avoid addressing my current mental state, I don't know. But being the type of person I am, if I can help somebody else and focus on them and help their needs, then I'm not wallowing in self-pity. And by studying verifiable evidence in the mental health field, I'm hoping it will help myself as well as helping others.
So, Michelle, in closing, what would you say, and I know I already asked you this in a way, but what would you say to somebody who is starting a new relationship, but yet there were warning signs and there were red flags that they've already noticed as far as somebody trying to control their every move? What would you say to them before they decide to take that next step and get married?
It's really hard to see those things when you're in a new relationship because, like me, and I would be the world's worst to say, well, she should have recognized, she should have done this, she should have done that. But when you're in the whirlwind of new love and flattery and the trips and the gifts and the affections, it's just so hard to imagine what may be laying on down the line. And I would like for both men and women, abuse is not selective anymore, to pay attention and really enjoy the present. But if you have the red flags, the finality of it all is going to last so much longer than the roses or the diamonds or the out to eat or the Bahamas trips. The aftermath of impending abuse, you know, that's going to be a lifetime, whether it be mentally, emotionally, or physically. Just be aware of the signs and realize that you don't have to go through with the marriage. You don't have to go through with the engagement. Protect yourself and look for ways to pad your own future because, as I had said previously, you yourself is all you can really count on.
Again, our guest today has been Michelle. She survived domestic violence in a major way, a near-death experience. Her ex-husband, now in prison, where he will be behind bars up until at least 2036. And he has already lost appeals when trying to get that sentencing reduced or the conviction changed. For WGNS News, I'm Scott Walker.